like a sunshine. Shine on me.
Cascalora Center for the Arts. Sunday is November 18th, and it's going to be a wonderful, wonderful celebration, and with lots of special guests like Eddie Gale, one of Destiny Muhammad's many collaborators along her journey. And it's going to be really great. And she's going to be joining us in the studio. But she's not here right now. So let me tell you a little bit more about Destiny, and then we will play something else while we wait for her to join us. Destiny Muhammad is a recording, performing artist, singer-songwriter, fashion on harp. Her genre, Celtic to Coltrane, is cool and eclectic with a feel of jazz and storytelling to round out the sonic experience. And perhaps you caught Destiny as a part of Afro Solo's Jazz in the Gardens this summer, and that was simply fantastic. Destiny as leader of her own, I believe it was a quartet, and she had a special guest, Eddie Gale was special guest, and then the other artist who was on the bill was able to join her as well, and that was really Rikash Killian on many instruments, among them the cello, and so he was fantastic too. So they were able to like give us like a real wonderful concluding song with everybody participating, so that was just really great. Destiny is open for the Oakland East Bay Symphony, share the stage with jazz masters Calvin Keys, whom I just saw at the 37th annual, well, it's 37th anniversary of the San Francisco Big Band. That was under direction of David Hardiman, Sr., and that was really a great concert, and it's a simply fantastic CD, so you want to pick that up. That was on Monday, this past Monday. This has been a real music-filled week, and boy, to top it off with Destiny, that's going to be really wonderful. She's also performed with Ambrose Akinmuri, Marcus Shelby, Omar Sosa, John Santos, and jazz divas Diane Witherspoon, Denise Perrier, who was also part of that 37th anniversary CD release party and fundraiser for the American Cancer Society. Destiny is also headlining for the Women in Jazz concert series in San Francisco, and she's expanding her musical ideals with her project's song, which stands for Strings of a Nubian Groove, Nubian String Ensemble, and the Destiny Muhammad Project, and the Richard Howell Quintet. She is Governor Emeritus and Educational Chair of the Recording Academy, San Francisco chapter, and she's also the Jazz Heritage Center of San Francisco Jazz Ambassador and an ASCAP Songwriter Awardee. So we're going to play something else by Eddie Gale. It's raining. Isn't that crazy? Sunny yesterday, rainy today. So we're going to play The Rain, which is featuring Faye Carroll, while we get our sister Destiny Muhammad in the studio. So here we go.
How are you this morning?
I'm fine. I was just telling our guests all about you, and so I've read your bio, and I've talked you up. Only thing I didn't mention was that the last time I saw you was at the Spirit Sound Silence Retreat, where you and Reverend Liza just worked some magic at the One Life Institute.
Oh, yeah, that's really a fun experience we get a chance to do 4 times a year.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, yeah. So 5020, the concert, really the event of the year. So tell us what you have planned for your 50th Sojourn celebration and the 20th anniversary of your musical career.
Absolutely. That's what it is. So this year what we're planning for, what's going to take place on Sunday, rather, is really for folks to see the many facets of me in my musical experience. And so what will happen is there will be the Full House band, which will show an aspect that's kind of more of a fusion, inspirational side. There will be the Destiny Muhammad Project that will show me doing some straight-ahead jazz. It will feature Blue Note artist Eddie Gale. There will also be Strings of a Nubian Groove, which is my string ensemble, which does a crossover of classical, Celtic, and spiritual. And then we're going to have Dominion, a cappella ensemble that's going to come and actually sing a couple of my compositions with me, which is going to be incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell me about the last part. What's the name of the ensemble that's going to join you and you're going to be singing? Because you just do it all. You're a band leader, you know, you're a songwriter, you play that celestial instrument, the harp, and then you move throughout all these various genres. So
yeah.
This last one, I don't know that particular group. So tell me about that last one that you just mentioned.
So Dominion is a Bay Area-based a cappella ensemble, and they primarily sing a cappella music. And the person who founded the group is Valerie L. Brown, who has moved to Hawaii, but they've been taken over by their leader, Meredith. Oh, I don't remember Meredith's last name, but they have been primarily singing a cappella songs. But I think periodically they sing accompaniment with the actual music. And so they're going to sing a couple of my compositions to be accompanied by myself, the Destiny Muhammad Project, as well as the Full House Band.
Mm-hmm. All right. Spell the name of the group, because I don't know if I'm hearing you right.
Dominion.
D-O-M.
Uh-huh. Yes.
D-O-M-I. Oh, like the biblical dominion, having dominion of the earth and all that kind of good
stuff.
Yes. That's yeah, and you got a name like Destiny and Dominion. My goodness. Wow. Yeah. Congratulations on the great article in the East Bay Express. Really, really
that was
nice.
Great.
Nice.
Thank you so much. Big kudos to Whitney Fanoff, who is now the musical director for a musical editor, if you will. Free State Express. She literally sought me out. A couple of other editors were coming, but to interview me, but their schedules were full. She said, "Well, I need to do it myself then."
Nice, nice. Yeah, and you were at the Awaken Cafe. I mean, all these wonderful, you know, names, which sort of are like affirmations within themselves. And then you got
absolutely
a photograph, and you got this trumpet in your ear. You're just like, ah.
And that, oh my, isn't that the truth? And that is a beautiful mural at the Parkway Theater that is a mural of ancestor Khalil Shaheed.
Ah, perfect,
and
perfect.
It was really perfect because he was my wonderful, incredible, one of my wonderful, but really like the top jazz mentor for me and an all-around good friend. Love him and still do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell us about your journey from, you were raised in Southern California. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, your journey from cutting hair and doing all these other things to being, you know, destined to pick up that harp and then, you know, moving between all these different genres, you know, from Celtic to Coltrane. I mean, that's a span. I mean, that's a serious span. Because, you know, you think about Coltrane, and Coltrane was in South Asia. I mean,
right.
You know, his concept was universal. So
that's
it's like,
right.
Hmm.
Absolutely. So for myself, when I first came to the harp, I came to the harp, the instrument itself, as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first started playing, the things that were brought to me to learn were Celtic tunes. And Celtic compositions, if you will, Irish jigs and reels and such. And so my affinity for the music, I recognize, is because I could hear the rhythms of the 6/8, the 9/8, and the 3/4 that come from the African concept, which, by the way, I just had the opportunity to speak with Professor Pascal Piem, who is a jazz instructor at San Francisco, not San Francisco State, but San Francisco University. And he attested to that fact of what I had been studying of the movement of the African coming into Ireland or the British Isles and bringing that rhythm and how that sound was embraced by the Celts. So when I heard it, I didn't know that, but I knew that I liked it. I liked the way it felt, and I said, I'm getting ready to learn this and have some fun with it. So when I bring a rhythm section on to participate in a Celtic tune, or I bring my string ensemble, which are African American based, they add what my folks call they stank on it, and it just evolves it into what we understand it to be. Just it's good music, it's fun, and you get out there and dance or just move your head and tap your feet to it because you can hear what's happening within it.
So how does a mother name her child Destiny? I mean, it's like, wow, what an unusual name, but so fitting.
The Bay Area named me Destiny.
Really?
The Bay Area named me Destiny. The Bay Area itself, the spirit of the Bay Area,
mm-hmm.
named me that when I moved here. When I got here when I moved here in 1994,
mm-hmm.
I was still this other person, but the evolution was taking place. By the time I moved to Oakland, By the time I moved to Oakland, it spoke loud and clear. This is what we call you. We call you Destiny, and you belong to us.
Yeah. You and your husband are on the road quite a bit, particularly on the Pacific West Coast. I mean, you're up, you know, north, Seattle, Oregon, you know, down south, and then all between, and you're just being called on, you know, to pull from all your various persons. You know,
absolutely.
you're being called to play people into the other realm. you know, you're being called on to celebrate, you know, women that are doing some really wonderful work, you know, at, you know, the annual tribute that they do in San Francisco. The Madam C.J. Walker Awards event. I mean, you know, like you got on your invitation, you know, Samba Funk. I was like, okay, harp doing funk. Well, you haven't heard Destiny Muhammad until she can, like, do funk. Like, funk on, wow, because people think about the harp as an orchestral instrument. And you know, basically, you know, you sort of just meditate with it, and you sort of like think about the angels, and you just sort of do that. But no, you have people grooving, dancing, jumping out their seat saying hallelujah. So it's like, ooh.
it's true, because that is I shouldn't say unfortunate, but that is how the harp has been shaped, and in particularly if you look at Kemet and or Benin by the Western world, where you see the images of the harp and then you read the dialogue and speak of the harpist, him or herself, is that our job was to channel the messages of the gods, of the gods to the people. That was our job. Only the women who were harpists were allowed to see the gods while they were channeling that information. So you have it. So it just come off very celestial, just from that experience, and you move into primarily Westernized European classical music, and it still is considered very celestial, but it also can be very rigorous. A lot of the compositions by Debussy and Handel and Mozart for harp are rigorous, and they appear and they sound very fluid and sweet, but a harpist's hands are strong. We lay hands on you, boy, you won't forget. So you have that experience with the instrument, but for those of us who hear the other possibilities with orchestral instruments, like a harp, like a violin, like a trumpet, you hear that. We, especially if you put it in the hands of someone who has been exposed to other genres of music or other possibilities of sound, we hear the instrument doing something else. And so we bring what we hear as best we can to that instrument. So when you hear Regina Carter, and she picks up a violin, she can go anywhere from playing, like I was speaking of a Debussy or a beautiful Mozart sonata, but then she'll turn around and put that same stank on it and do some Stevie Wonder, and be able to move the two back and forth with grace and ease. Dorothy Ashby was an incredible jazz harpist. She would do some beautiful sweet piece of maybe Amazing Grace or some other classical piece, and then fall right out and do Thou Swell by a modern day composer, a trying to remember the name of who wrote that. Even she worked with Stevie Wonder, so she would do things with Stevie Wonder. She worked with, I want to say, Dizzy Gillespie. So here she's bringing who and what she is to the music, and transforming the possibilities of the instrument, and taking the limits of it off because she's already felt unlimited. So I walk in the footsteps of those before me who said, unlimit yourself. The possibilities are endless, and even if someone attempts to typecast you, don't allow them to.
Yeah, wow. I was thinking about Alice Coltrane, too, as you were calling names.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you know you mentioned Coltrane, and you don't say John Coltrane, you say Coltrane. So that's Alice Coltrane, you know, John Coltrane, Robbie Coltrane, you know, the whole works, all the Coltranes.
Absolutely. Alice is the same way. Alice, and there were folks who would subtly say that what she was doing was not jazz, but Alice never allowed anyone to limit her on what she could do or wanted to do sound wise on harp. She never allowed anyone to tell her what she couldn't do, and she did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just thinking about sort of going back to what you were talking about, the harps and their Celtic myths, you know, with gods with harps, and there are, you know, Greek myths with gods with harps, and
mm-hmm.
I was wondering if there are, you know, you're talking about the Nubian groove, you know, that's the roots, African folks,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then you mentioned mm-hmm. Kemet, you know, that's another, you know, so we're talking about classical African civilizations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I was wondering, like, okay, so get a little deep on us here. Let's go into the metaphysics of this harp and the connection to ancestors and connection to Orisha and connection to all of these entities that are bigger than us, but they are us, you know?
Yes.
Because I hear that the Orishas, that they once walked on the planet like us, and then they just did so much great stuff that now they're like, you know, celestial beings. You know, so it's like, okay, well, we all have the potential to be bigger than what we appear to be, right?
Yes. 1,000 times yes. And that's where the possibilities of us unlimiting ourselves, and it can be painful, because sometimes in the process of unlimiting ourselves, we have to separate ourselves from the thought forms that we call parents and friends and family so that we can evolve like that. So that we can continue our evolution. If you look in the Bible where Jesus, as he's making his ascension, he says, I have to go. I have to go. I have to continue to pace this way. I'm probably paraphrasing very badly, but my personal view is that he allowed a crucifixion to happen because his attachment to folks that said, well, we just want you to stay here. But if I don't go, you won't continue to evolve, because it would be too easy for you to say, let's just go over to Jesus' house, he'll fix it.
Mm-hmm.
That's my viewpoint, and that's where I stand on that. Just going back in regards to what you were saying about the evolution of the ancestor and the heart,
mm-hmm.
during the time, the dynasties of the pharaohs, no pharaoh, male or female, I know that there were female pharaohs, that no pharaoh would be pharaoh without having a harpist alongside that individual. And so usually at the close of the day, after the pharaoh had been dealing with his or her subjects all day, setting down mandates and policies and such for the land, when they retired to their chambers, the harpist would be at their side as they were resting and would play something soothing for them to assist them in going to sleep, and not just going to sleep, to taking that celestial journey where they could go and create at a higher level.
Hmm.
That's one part of my understanding from my reading. Speaking of the Orisha, I have not just once, but about 3 times been asked to play at Bembe for Oshun.
Oh, really? Huh.
Oh, yes. In which, if anyone has been in an Oshun experience, a celebration occurring, and one time in particular, it was the making of a sister's head, and it was incredible. I want to, and one or two of them, Tariq and I together, and the first one, it was myself by myself. I tell you what, the energy was hot. You don't have to believe nothing, but Oshun was having a day. So he was enjoying it, and folks were going in like we see at the Church of God in Christ and falling out. And
yeah.
It was that level of experience because from what I have been told, just in my little talk around the tradition, is that Oshun really enjoys the instruments.
Mm.
So I brought what I bring to the table just based on who I am. She, the entity known as Oshun, enjoyed it. And to the point where she just, I could say this unabashedly, that next 45, 90 days was mighty lovely because she followed us around and showed up in 10,000 manifestations. There were ladybugs all over the place and gold and buns and pretty things and orange everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's awesome. That's really awesome. Yeah, wow. Yeah, I want to let our audience know again that we're speaking to Destiny Muhammad's Harpist from the Hood, who is talking about her special 50/20 concert experience this coming Sunday, November 18th, 3 p.m. at the Malaga Cascalar Center for the Arts, 1428 Alice Street in downtown Oakland. And part of the proceeds from the tickets are going to go to the Malaga Cascalar Center for the Arts because it supports so many wonderful, fine artists and fine programming. And you can get tickets at Brown Paper Tickets. And you can also visit DestinyMuhammadProject.com to get more information about this wonderful woman who is so multi-recorded. Like, do you have a new CD that you're going to be unveiling on Sunday as well?
No, I am in the process of creating a new CD that will be coming out in 2013. So the objective is I have two sonic ideas of a dedication that will also include some inspiration on the music of Dorothy Ashby. The other is a CD on spirituals with jazz influences based on in there as well.
Nice. Yeah, and then at your concert, talk a little bit more about what's going to happen on Sunday. You've got your guest strings. I want you to name them for the Nubian Groove, and then you've got dancer Jatan Maxwell. I believe I saw you in one of her programs, Old Oakland, a few years ago. Is that Jatan?
Yes, that was on the Armin. Absolutely.
Yeah.
She created a piece called The Invisible Womb, which was dealing with her finding out that she didn't have the ability to conceive, that she was told that she couldn't conceive. Anything is possible. But she was told she couldn't, and she's so devastated because she really wanted to bring forth a physical child. And so she wrote this play called The Invisible Womb and actually asked me to be a part of the production by way of commissioning me to write a piece for that play called Woman.
And then for the
strings of Anubian Groove, my two main players who have been there, solid like rockers, Tariqa Lewis on violin, who was also a Black Panther and has played with John Handy for as far back before I even came to the Bay Area. And then Vince Tolliver, who plays Viola, who's also a teacher at Skyline. I want to say he's head of the music department at Skyline High School, and he is definitely on board to play with us on Sunday.
Okay, yeah, and you've got Larry Van, who is phenomenal.
The Groove Merchant. He's going to be there in the Destiny Muhammad Project as well as playing alongside with the Full House Band, which is Carrie Streeter, Lance Zipplin, and Paul Hunt. They're the founding members of a Full House Band. Yeah.
Okay, nice. I was mentioning to our audience that if they miss the Afro Solo concert in the Gardens, where you were just holding it together, the only woman up there, like band leader and performer and singing. It's like just you know, like conducting everybody at the end. Like you had Cash Killian in there, you know, Eddie Gale, all those men there. Yes, ma'am.
Ah, <you're sorry>. All right. It is so good. But you know, it is, that's just respect. That's so much love and respect. All of those gentlemen have watched me evolve into what I'm becoming and becoming more of, and they're so loving and so supportive. They're just happy to get behind me and just about whatever it is I want to do musically. I am ultra thankful, ultra, ultra thankful. And my husband, is, I include him as a band member. Because if I say there are a couple of times, he said, no, you don't want to, please, I really want to do that. And he can hear and see what the possibilities are. He's like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't jump on early. I said, that's okay, let's just do it now. Let's go. Let's make it happen now. Mm-hmm. So I'm really phenomenally blessed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just love seeing you with your husband, Chris Well Muhammad. I mean, you're just such a lovely couple, and the energy is always so good, and just wonderful, just sort of just, even if you never pluck a string or sing a note, it's just wonderful being in your company. It's always so like, you know, like you're always in a state of just sort of being grounded and just being in a state of mindfulness and consciousness. It's just really great, you know. It's like destiny and Muhammad. Muhammad meaning worthy of praise, right?
That's right.
So it's like, okay, girlfriend, you know, you got the name and you got the mission too, right?
And I love that you said mindfulness, being mindful that I do. So that I do have the missions, which means that I've got to be mindful. Some people, you can kind of fluctuate throughout the day and just kind of not be mindful. I'm not going to lie. The ancestors would do something to, and you can't see it just then when they trip you up like, hey, straighten that up.
Right. Well, you know, you got Khalil blowing in your ear, and I love that story you tell about Khalil Shaheed, and you know, founder of the Oaktown Jazz Workshop, and you know, kept it moving at 57th Street Gallery with that jam session on Monday night. Why don't you tell us, you know, the Khalil Shaheed story about sort of that encouragement that he gave you that you told us about at his home going. Earlier this year, actually.
Oh, my goodness. So Khalil saw me playing at the Jack London Farmers Market literally almost 16 years ago, and I was out there doing my thing, just playing away, and he walked up on me, and I didn't know him from Adam, but I had met his wife, Kate, at a coffee house not too far where I used to play at, and she used to bring Savannah as their daughter in. So here he walks up on me with her, and he looks down at me with the Khalil look, this kind of no-nonsense Miles Davis, and he goes, yeah, I had this jam session that happens over here at Blues Deal. You need to come on soon and come and hit. I said, oh, okay. I was like, wow, that'll be great. You know, I'll get a chance to sit with these guys and learn a little something about jazz. Well, look, girl, I got into that jam session. It is Ed Kelly, Walter Savage, Khalil Shaheed, and I'm trying to think of a couple other folks that I did know, and Frankie Kelly was sitting in the audience just chilling, waiting for it to be time for her to go up on stage, right? So I'm unbagging my harp, and I'm like, oh, boy, I'm going to see if these guys are good. I'm going to learn something today. Khalil announces on the stage, yeah, we got this Sears Harper's in the house, and she's going to set it up. All right, Destiny, hit it. I was like, I had just learned a little bit of Little Sunflower, by Steve Hubbard, and I start to play a little bit of it. And Ed Kelly looks down at me and growls and just turns up the volume on it, speeds it up. I think he even changes it. I couldn't keep up with him. I could not keep up with him. I was like, and everybody was laughing, and it was fun, and they were clapping. They just, you know, and I just looked around. I felt like a little kid, and all the big kids had just been kind of throwing me up in the air, you know, and banging me around. You know how big kids do, little kids? And I was
yes.
One day, that was my introduction. Yes, I said, one day I'm going to get good, and I'm going to hire each one of y'all to play with me, and I'm going to be handing you the check. I didn't get a chance to get Ed Kelly. He had stepped off the planet. All right. And Walter Savage had moved, I want to say, to Ohio. But Khalil, I think I've paid Khalil a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
Frankie, she coming too.
Right. Nice. That's great. That's really awesome. Yeah. And Yeah, it's just it's always so wonderful to talk to you, and you know, sort of, you know, calling Ed Kelly's name, you know, and Khalil Shaheed, you know, two wonderful men who, you know, really were about making this music accessible and making it, you know, sort of keeping it where it's supposed to be, you know, with the people. You know, it's just another vehicle for us to express ourselves, and it's a real important vehicle. It's, you know, it's one that, you know, helps us sort of resolve stuff in a healthy way. You know, you can play a song, you can like, you can work through that, you know? You see those, you see, you know, I'm sure, you know, as a musician, you probably sometime come on stage, you have some stuff you need to work out, and you just work it out through your harp.
You don't even know. I'll be sat there smiling. I said, as soon as I get off this stage, I'm going to kill them. But I love, by the time I've had the opportunity to be on stage, whatever it was that had caught up with me to try to take me off of my point, by the time I hit that stage, I was front and center. There was no deviation because there was no going back. The commitment was already established.
Right, yeah. And before you get out of here, because I know you got to move because you teach and you do all these things, are you going to have your little kids performing or anything? Because I know the last time I came to one of your celebrations of your sort of saluting, you know, your time here on the planet, you had like this wonderful chorus of these great children singing. It's like, oh, my goodness.
So I have two young people who actually, the three of us, all were studying with Khalil. One of them is still someone studying with O-Town Jazz, but she is now one of the SF Jazz band members. She and this other young man, they both had went on and SF Jazz has called them to be a part of that entourage, and they are just, they have really evolved sonically. I'm so proud of them. So Matt Wong, who'll be there on piano.
And Matt is great.
He is really great. Remember when he was this little guy at sea level? This boy is tall as me. And then Maureen Side, she played flute. And she's studying there for a while with Kimberly Jackson, who's a wonderful band.
Oh, Kimberly Jackson is awesome, yeah.
Jazz flautist. She was studying with her SF Jazz called with Maureen, and Matt are two of the young people that I've been able to grab. And they, matter of fact, the mothers actually sent me an email that said, oh, are you going to have your concert this year? Because last year I didn't have it so that I could go visit my dad. And so we're back, and I said yes, and so they're going to be here with me, and they're going to be playing in the Destiny Muhammad Project, and I absolutely just am so pleased to have them on board now while I can get them, because I know they're going to move the route of Ambrose Akinfenwa and Dana Stevens and stuff, because it just feels like that, so I got them now, and they'll be on board on Sunday.
Yeah, because you fierce like that. And in closing, I just wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about what's called the African harp, you know, the kora. And there are a lot of different kinds of koras, and people are probably familiar with the kora. And I was wondering, do you play kora? And if you could talk a little bit about some of the similarities and differences between the African kora or lute and the harp.
The kora itself is an evolution of what we see in the Meadow Nature or the hieroglyphics, that was known as the Ananga. And so if that evolution moves down into a, if I recall, not Ivory Coast, but a Ghana I'm not bringing up too much, the kora itself is an evolution of the Ananga, and the current present day European formation of the harp is an evolution. It's the current evolution, and it's in its current state is only a little over 200 years old of those harps that you just spoke of. So all of them are harps, and I know folks try to consider them. This is the African harp, and this is the mother. These are the children. This is the mother. These are the children. And with evolution, and we see it with evolution, other things evolve on the instrument in order so it too can continue to grow. So as the harp continues to expand itself and its evolution, it moves from being diatonic to what we know as chromatic. And chromatic allows it to the ability to play in what you refer to as symphonic orchestral situations, and in jazz where you've got the changes and the movement of the music happening quickly. Prior to that, the harp did not have the anangan chord, didn't have pedals on the bottom, and folks kneeled to play it. As it is as in its current evolution now, as what's known as a consigrand or pedal harp, the pedals allow the individual to put their feet in motion with the hands and allow us to change the keys and move chromatically faster than we were allowed to do at its first appearance on the planet. It's all good because we know ourselves are evolved. When we look at our children and their thought process is faster than ours was, ours is at this present stage, but they're moving at the speed of light because of where they are right now, but they are still our children, and their children will evolve beyond what they have done. That's the nature of evolution. Nothing stands still. It has to continue to grow and expand.
Mm-hmm. Wow, cool. Well, we are so looking forward to your Destiny Muhammad 5020, the concert. It's going to be the concert, and folks need to be in the house, 3 p.m. at the Malanga Cascalore Center for the Arts. I just love saying the name, just sort of calling Malanga Cascalore into
the
space.
Come on now.
Oh, my gosh. That's such a beautiful man.
And I just want to say this also is that if anyone has groups of people that are interested in coming, there are group rates available. You want to call 510-465-7794. So group rates of six or more, call 510-465-7794. And you can also email us at soundsculptress@gmail.com. soundsculptress@gmail.com.
Okay. Well, congratulations again, Destiny. Looking forward to seeing you on Sunday and just sort of just getting caught up in that sound sculpture that you're going to be erecting right in front of our faces and within and around us. We're all going to be a part of that sound sculpture, you know. That's how it works.
I know you're going to be there. You are going to be there.
Oh, yes, I am so going to be there. Yes, yes, yes.
Hello.
yes, I'm so going to be there. Definitely, Destiny.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for having me on the air. I know you better be there, Wanda. I'll be looking for you.
All right. You take good care.
You as well. Peace.
All right. Peace and blessings. So we are speaking to Destiny Muhammad, and we are going to play a song while we get our next guest into the studio, Dr. Zachariah Duff, to talk about Diamantakora and their home season concert, which is going to be really fun. And let's see, what am I going to play? I was thinking about playing another Eddie Gale, because I wish I had that African, Little Sunflower. That would be so cool to play of Destiny Muhammad. I have to try to get that for some other time. Let's see. I think we're going to play something a little, let's see, gosh. It's like I have all these choices, right? I think we'll play Dwight Tribble's Little Africa. We're going to play a little bit of that while I get our next guest into the studio.
Summer's just begun in the blazing sun, laughter, song, and fun you play. Mm-hmm. my Africa. You with distant touch all the joy you bring, how my heart does sing. The truth is really you are king. Under native stars, the pyramids have told. The spell within your eyes, it's oh so much. Can I easier. Ooh, child, Wilson. Someday, when this world is much brighter, oh, 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 child, things are gonna get easy.
Pick one. Listen to your message.
Oh,
Pick two.
Oh,
rewrite.
That was Dwight Tribble from his latest CD, Cosmic, and that was Ooh Chow. And we're so wonderfully pleased to be able to have a nice conversation with Destiny Muhammad, who is celebrating her 50th year on the planet and her 20th year in music this Sunday at the Malanga Cascalora Center for the Arts in Oakland, downtown Oakland. And that's 3 o'clock on November 18th. Be there. Be there. So we're going to play something from the archives. Ben Vereen was at the Raz Room a little bit earlier this year, and here he is talking a little bit about his career. We're not going to be able to listen to it all, but we're going to make a nice stab at it. And here we go. What would I like to know? That is so cool. Well, gosh, maybe we should talk about what's bringing you out here to San Francisco. You've got a new CD and you've got a new show, and maybe you could tell us about what you're bringing to the Raz Room June 12th.
What I'm bringing to the Raz Room?
Yeah, yeah. What a
greatness.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Give us some details. Who? Because I think you're bringing a band, right?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am.
And some new material?
Yeah, some new material, and, you know, I'm working on a show that I'm taking to Broadway, so I'll be working on that there, and so it's going to be exciting.
Oh, so you're going to test it out on us. That's great. We love that. Okay. So you're going to be, I believe, sort of bringing back some old favorite tunes and
some
honoring
oldies,
some of your favorite
goodies.
Folks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Oldies but goodies, yeah. That's...
Oldies but goodies. You know, people that, you know, that we grew up with and have touched my life. You know, people I've worked with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sammy Davis, Frank Sinatra, you know, people
yeah.
like that, Bob Fosse, Tom O'Horgan, you know, and Hair. I did Hair, matter of fact, right there in San Francisco.
You did?
The Orpheum Theater, yeah.
Wow.
I came up some time ago, and I found, I discovered a guy named Michael Philip Thomas.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And he was doing Burger. So I hired him in Los Angeles, and he hurt his back. And so they called me to come up to the Orpheum Theater to cover for him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we, you know, we really got to be good friends years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was at the On Broadway Theater where there's No Place to Be Somebody, Charles Gardone's play.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, so San Francisco and I have a history.
Yeah.
I lived in Berkeley for a while.
You did?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
Matter of fact, there was a guy named Wasserman, I believe. And he wrote an article on me. I did my first concert at the On Broadway Theater in those years.
Yeah.
And got my launch there.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Wow. So you have some dear memories of the Bay Area.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Dear memories.
Wow, that is so awesome. I was reading your lovely, but I just love that caricature of you on your website. It's so cute.
Well, thank you.
And then your photographer, you got some great photographs, you know, when they're sort of, you know, going through the... you know, sort of showing you the different looks of Ben Vereen.
Yes, yes.
Those are really
Thank
nice,
you.
Too. And you've gotten, like, what, 10 doctorates?
Is that right?
Yeah, I'm like, well, you're like...
Out of them.
Yeah, wow, I was like, so wonderful. And I was looking at one was from the Medgar Evers College there in
Medgar Evers. Yes.
Yeah, is that in Brooklyn? No.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
Brooklyn.
It is Brooklyn, right.
Mm-hmm.
And they sponsor... A ritual every year, the second Saturday in June. It's called Libations for the Ancestors, and it's an international pouring for our ancestors that died or made that passage, you know, during the European slave trade. And
really? I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and it's a really
well,
old celebration.
I'm honored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I thought, wow, how fitting, you know, sort of looking at, you know, your really famous role in Roots. And I was watching some of the segments on Oprah's website. And,
oh, yes, when we did the reunion.
Yeah, yeah, and the part where you talked about how you really wanted to be in the film and how your agent was saying, well, you know, you're a song and dance man. They need an actor.
Oh, yes. Yes.
That was funny.
Yeah, I fired him.
Oh, good. You need someone with vision, for sure.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so I was wondering if you could talk about You know, I was thinking one if we could start with, you know, that Chicken George character, and sort of, you know, your preparation, you know, within your life for that role as the child of a rape, and then, you know, sort of being known by that, you know, that bird, the chicken which is used to venerate the ancestors and, you know, sort of stands for, you know, life, you know, fertility, because every day.
Look at you. You got it all down. You don't need this. If you read, just write it.
Well, you might not agree with me, you know.
Thank you, my queen. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but I just thought about, you know, sort of the whole renewal, and then within your personal life, you know, finding out that you have another family after having the wonderful.
That was until later in years. My baby daughter, Karan, came to me one day and said, "Dad, you know, Mom has her history, but we don't, you know, you, and that's it." Mm. And I decided to go for my search. It's interesting that I did roots, and I really didn't have any knowledge of my past until, you know, I went to Europe with Sammy Davis Jr., and he said, you know, you have to get a passport. And I went down to get a passport, and I found out that I wasn't who I was.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's when my search began. You know, so for me, doing roots was really interesting because I was doing a part of a story of our legacy, but I hadn't found mine.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite overwhelming. It was quite overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah, I was wondering, so when you like you have, it sounded like you had a wonderful, you know, childhood and family that raised you.
Oh, you did. I did.
Yeah.
Love personified.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was interesting because when I found this out, the woman who raised me, Pauline Green,
mm-hmm.
When I found it out and I came back from Europe and I looked at her, and she was really taken by this whole discovery because she would never wanted me to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at her and I told her, I said, "You're the only mother I know. You're the only eyes I saw when I looked up, you know, so you're my mom, you know."
Mm-hmm.
And so we left it that way. That's when she came and she told me what had happened. You know, and she told me about my mother. And when my daughter said, you know, "Dad, we got to find, you know, who your people are." And we went looking.
Mm-hmm.
And I found them about 4 years ago, 5 years ago now.
Oh, it's been that recent?
Yes, it's been that recent.
Oh,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And this is an interesting thing, and I'm writing it in my book, is that they lived an hour. My original mother lived an hour away from me, but she didn't know who I was. She went looking for me.
Hmm.
And when, you know, in 1946, when you say, you go to the police and say, you know, I've lost a child, they weren't interested, you know. I'm supposed to be an African-American woman, you know.
Hmm.
So she stayed there 2 years looking for me.
Wow.
And then she went to, she lived in Connecticut, 1 hour away from me. So you got to read the book because it's very interesting about how we got back together. She's no longer with us, of course.
Right, yeah, she passed.
Yes.
That's amazing. Yeah, and so how did your mother, you know, your mother, you know, who raised you, how did they find you?
Well, it's a couple of stories. One is that my mother, it's in the book. Yes, read the book.
Okay, I will totally read. I'm not one of those people, you tell me the punchline and I don't listen to the joke.
Yeah,
you tell me the ending and I will still read the book. Don't worry.
Okay, wonderful. Well, what happened was supposedly my mother, my birth mother, was they met in a storm. And she was, supposedly, according to the story I got, that she was homeless. And my mother took her to, the woman who raised me took her to her apartment.
Hmm.
And after I was born, she was sent, the woman left. But that wasn't the story that I found out.
Hmm.
And so when I found out that my mother actually left her with friends there, left me with friends in Miami, went back to look at my sister and brother to take care of her children she had prior to another marriage, and came back and I was gone.
Hmm. Oh,
so that's the story I got from my family,
right?
Me, you know, the Pearsons.
Yeah. Hmm. Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, and then your character, you know, Chicken George, you know, he goes away and then he comes back and
his family, and then brings his family to freedom.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and then he tells his grandson the story of that first African.
That's right.
It's like coming full circle,
and
it so mirrors your real life, doesn't it?
Yes, it is.
I mean, it's like. like, whoa, what's going on here? You know, the synergy, you know, the serendipity.
You know, what's so interesting is that, you know, how I got that role. Mm-hmm. I mean, out of all the actors, because I wasn't an actor. I'd done Pippin, I'd done Broadway, mm-hmm. but I hadn't been in any films or anything like that. And it was fortuitous that the producer happened to be in the audience of one of my shows. I used to do a character called Bert Williams, who, you know, was one of our early performers, great stars,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, suffered the ridicules of prejudice in this country. And, you know, he said, yeah, I don't mind being, you know, a black performer. He says, but in America, it's an inconvenience. That was his line.
Mm-hmm.
And so I used to do a parody on him, which I got ridiculed for, you know, but I used to do a parody on him about the ridiculousness of what we had to go through. And I was doing it in Savannah, Georgia. And I looked up one day, and there was the producer, Stan Margulies, in the audience. And he saw my Bert Williams, and he came backstage. He said, I want you to be my Chicken George. I didn't know who a Chicken George was or what a Chicken George was. I hadn't read the book. And I said, yes, because I'd heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, boom, and I got the role. And it was quite a journey.
Right.
Quite a journey. To this day, mm-hmm. we still talk about it. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's 30-some-odd years later, we're still talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, because it was for you. It was definitely for you in a lot of ways. I mean, and it's probably becoming more and more apparent why as you know, you have, you know, as the years pass and the moments pass, like, wow, yeah. Because I was just thinking about when I read that story about Bert Williams and, you know, you're portraying him, and I thought about, you know, the minstrel tradition and the Scottsboro Boys, you know, on Broadway, you know, as a musical, and reverse minstrel with the black folks wearing white face. and then I don't know if you know this playwright, but you probably do. Her name is, because she's in New York, and you know the folks there, Dale Orlander Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you do know. Okay, well, she's at Berkeley Rep now, doing her Black and Blue Boys, Broken Men.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about, you know, your humanitarian work and your lectures around a lot of things about sort of things that encourage young people, particularly young men and women who might not have everything they think they need in their lives to be successful, you know, how to be resourceful.
Well, it's all within you, isn't it?
Mm-hmm,
it's just tapping within you. You know, we look without for everything, but we need to look within, because within is all the resources that we need. You know, recently my last grandchild was born.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Moses. And
Moses?
And
wow.
So I, you know, my daughter gave me my baby grandchild. He's 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting in the room when he was born and put him in my hands, and I watched the pigment coming in.
Right.
And it seemed like Spirit was saying, if you need me, I'll be right in here, inside here. And we look outside for it. But within us is all that we need. Within us is the legacy. And we teach from within without to go out. And then we have our legacy in us, and all that we need is in Spirit, within us. You know, and that's what I try to teach from when I'm teaching an acting class, or I, you know, teach seminars of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right, yeah. But then, you know, you look at, you know, characters that Dale paints in her current play that she's performing, and these children, oh my goodness, their parents are so broken that...
Mm-hmm.
These kids, I mean, they do look within, and some of them are able to do some really remarkable things, but then when they become adults, they're still broken. So then they have flashbacks because of that trauma. So what do you do when the support network is not there to help you realize that you need some help to become truly healed?
That you look within yourself,
but there's not enough there because you don't have the tools because you're a little kid.
yes. So around you, you know, I believe that, you know, we're surrounded by angels that support us.
Mm.
Look, I was a kid from Brooklyn. I'm a kid from Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and all probability, I should not be who I am today. But one day, I was standing on the street corner, And I'm doing my kid thing. I was about 6 years old, 6, 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And this gentleman comes walking down the street, you know, my white brother, you know, comes mm-hmm. walking down the street. Out of all the kids on the block, he points to me and he says, "Is your mother home?" And he was a talent scout. And I was playing stickball. I wasn't dancing or singing. Mm-hmm. I was playing stickball.
Yeah.
The destiny.
Huh.
And I went upstairs. My mother said, "I want him to go to a dance school." She didn't know nothing about the theater. Take him.
Mm-hmm.
Take him, because I want him to have something better than what I've got. And that's how my journey began. It's like, it seems like spirit calls upon that which will make us who we are today if we're open and receptive to it. But how do we teach that to children? When they, you know, they're from families that do not have the resources to believe in themselves, to know that it's going to be all right because they've come to the planet to make it better. How do we give them those resources and teach them that? You know, we teach them how to make a living, but we don't teach them how to live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, churches are doing the best job that they can, you know, by relating, you know, well, you know, things are going to get better, you know, when you get to heaven, you know. But what about bringing heaven to earth?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what these children come. They bring us heaven by just being here on this earth. They bring a baby, a child born, is heaven on earth. And then we educate them.
Yeah. Yeah, we mess
enlightening
them up.
Them,
yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Enlightening them. You know, so I try to, in my teachings, is try to touch that within them to let it express itself. And from that basis, that's where I work when I teach classes.
Mm-hmm.
Within, out. Knock them out in.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I wonder if you could talk about, you know, your attraction to storytelling via performance art and how you used, your personal journey to inform your ethos.
To excuse me?
Your ethos.
My ethos?
Yeah, your ethics, you know, your principles, you know, how... Yeah, because, yeah, I mean, you have a really extensive and long and very well decorated, you know, insofar as all the different kinds of awards one can receive and honors one can receive, you know, career. And you're still going strong. I mean, like, seriously. So... You know, a lot of times people don't last in the business of entertainment because there are a lot of distractions.
I feel blessed.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say it's something greater than myself.
Mm.
Without myself, I probably wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. So something greater than myself makes me get out of bed in the morning. Something greater calls me,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I just have to give honor to that within me. You know, that, you know, that which keeps me going, as long as I'm here on this planet called Earth, you know, something within me greater than myself is the reason why I do what I do. And I give honor and praise to that. Call it God, Allah, Jesus, Elohim, Yahweh, whatever you choose to make mm-hmm. divine, it works.
Right. Yeah. So this attraction to storytelling, you tell mm-hmm. storytelling, you tell stories.
I do.
Yeah, and yeah, talk about that storytelling. I mean, that's real basic to the human, you know, species.
You know, Alex Haley was a storyteller.
Yeah.
You know, I just tell stories of my life, and hopefully somebody will be inspired.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the stories that I have to tell, and so I tell from a place of knowing, and in doing so, you know, somebody says, "I get it." And then I feel that my job is being done. When I do my show and doing songs, I try to tell the story that is personal to me. And somebody out there is having a similar situation.
Right.
And they can go, "Oh, I get it." And so that's why I love what I do, because I'm able to touch people as they touch me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a give and take sort of show. we share.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
I've had some wonderful mentors.
Along
my path, you know. So I'm just, and they're still coming.
Mm.
They're still coming, you know. And I get to share with people. I get to share with people like Usher. I get to share with people like Terrence Howard. I get to share with people that Big Boy and those guys.
Mm-hmm.
I get to share with the young people today.
Right. Yeah. I was reading Harry Belafonte's memoir. Which is, that's an endeavor. I don't know if yours is like 700, almost 800 pages long. Is your book that long?
Well, it may be long. Maybe one page.
But it was a fabulous journey. My song and in his book, I just love these type of journeys because he's lived long enough for it to be, you know, sort of really epic. And so you're reading a history book as lived by this person. And similarly, when one reads your book, you know, as you're writing, one is going to be reading a history book through your life, which makes it a lot easier to remember because we'll be identifying with you. And we like you, so we'll remember the details.
Thank you, my queen. Thank you.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us about, give us some stories. I mean, you know, you've had like some of your mentors are no longer with us, and some of the folks you hung out with, Gregory Hines, Sammy Davis Jr.
Gregory.
Oh my
Gregory.
Goodness, they're not with
Gregory.
Us anymore.
Yeah.
Nina Simone, you know.
Yeah. Well, Gregory.
Yeah.
Gregory. I went and saw Gregory in Jelly's last jam. Prior to it was 92. When I had my accident, and when I came back, started working to get myself back at Kessler back east, up in Jersey. It was my birthday that year, and I wanted to see a show. So I said, I want to see Jelly's last jam, and I went to see the show. And Gregory and Savion Glover and the cast just did a magnificent job. And after the show was over, Greg was standing there taking his bow. And he stopped his bow, and he said, he introduced me in the audience. And then he came up and he said, listen, Ben, if you can get ready, Keith David is leaving the show. Come this way. Come this way. And at the time, I could hardly lift my leg. I mean, I had a trach. And they had taken my spleen. I had a broken leg. I had a stroke on my right side. He said, if you can be ready, come this way. And I got there. I opened that show.
Wow.
I opened that show. And people and the doctors would say things like, you know, when I first had the accident in 1992, the doctor said, it's going to be at least 3 years before you'll ever walk again. And as far as his career, I think he should think about another career. So when they sent the occupational therapist to work with me on my motor skills, I didn't know what an occupational therapist was. Mm-hmm. I thought they were people to show me how to get a new job.
I thought so too until right now,
yeah, though. Exactly. Occupational therapy. Occupation, right?
Right.
So, show me how to get a new job. Because my doctor's telling me, you'll never work in show business again. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had a trach. You know, I took my spleen. Mm-hmm. I had a broken left leg. I had a stroke on my right side. I mean, that was done.
Yeah.
But the letters and the prayers that came through were amazing. Mm-hmm. They gave me encouragement. You know, and then Gregory said, come this way. And that was a green light.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 months later, after my accident, I walked on stage in Jelly's last jam.
Wow.
And all the doctors who said it would be 3 years before I'd walk again and get my career, they were sitting in the audience, their mouths gaped open. And Lexus sponsored my comeback.
Mm.
And it was packed. The place was packed.
Wow.
Packed. Standing room.
Yeah. Had you been driving a Lexus when you had the accident?
No.
Oh.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
No, I hadn't.
Mm.
I was driving a Corvette. And they didn't sponsor me, so I don't drive Corvettes anymore.
Yeah, they should have like sponsored you totally. It's like,
Yeah.
Wow, that is amazing, though. So I guess that sort of really shows a person that if you have something to strive toward, it makes it, I mean, the journey was difficult getting from being injured to becoming, you know, well enough to be able to do what you loved again.
Yeah, you know what it was? Usually in programming, the playbill, you put your bio, right?
Right.
So when they asked me what my bio, I said, for my bio, put footprints. So those who are reading, when they see me on that stage, they know how I got there.
Yeah.
You know the story of footprints, right?
It was
that within me carrying me.
Mm-hmm.
It was the God of my understanding carrying me.
Right.
And when I was going through all the turmoil and all the heartbreak and all the broken body, and my world was torn apart. Mm-hmm. And I turned and I said, well, you know, you promised you'd be with me when I got into this journey. You said you'd always be with me. He said, when you went through that whole thing, it was me carrying you through the storm.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't of your own cognizance. So, mm-hmm. you know, so I give praise and thanks. Praise and thanks.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And then your daughter, one of your daughters was in a really horrific car accident,
yes,
right?
Yes, I lost a daughter.
Was that before yours or after yours?
Yes, before mine.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That took me on a spin.
Mm-hmm.
That took me right out. It's still this day, you know. I've learned to live with it. Mm-hmm. Any bereaved parent out there knows. You know, you learn to live with it, but you never get over it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a part of your heart that's open. There's a hole.
Mm-hmm.
There's a hole there.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Wow. Yeah. I was, again, looking at your wonderful website. and I wanted you to talk about, you know, some of your projects. And then I want to go back to Sammy Davis Jr. and Nina Simone because, you're an insider.
Thank you.
Right. So I want you to tell us some stories. But I want you to talk about, you know, Stand for Diabetes. That's a great commercial that you have on your website.
Thank you. Well, Stand for Diabetes, I was diagnosed in 2007. And I didn't know what had happened, you know, what was going on. And I collapsed. And I was with my daughter. She said, Dad, she started saying, Dad, you don't hear the hitting all the pressures. You know, I said, you know, I'm fine. And I collapsed after doing a speech.
Mm-hmm.
And so she takes me to the hospital. This is my baby daughter, Karan.
Mm-hmm.
And so we go in the hospital, and they say, well, you know, if your blood sugar's all high, we'd like you to stay overnight. And so we can, you know, monitor you. And I said, well, you got my blood. You let me go. They said, no, you gotta stay overnight. Mm-hmm. So I stayed overnight, and I was doing my thing, you know, and in the hospital. Next morning, they came in, and they said, you got type 2 diabetes. And I said, and I looked at the guy in the bed next to me. I said, oh, shame, you got type 2 diabetes, because I know they're not talking to me. I'm Ben Marine. I don't get diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
They said, no, you got type 2 diabetes. And the thing about it is that, you know, when you don't know, you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so right away, the panic jumps in. You know, you hear about amputation, and you hear about death, and you hear all these things flash through your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And they flash through my mind. You know, oh, my God, how am I going to perform? How am I going to be back on stage? How's my life going to be? I'm going to have to be, because I played a character in Webster some years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Where they had the big needles,
yeah.
And the guy had to do, you know, the character had to do insulin, and, you know, the characters thought that he was a drug addict because he had his insulin kit.
Right.
And so I'm looking, I'm flashing back on the Webster. I'm saying, oh, my God, I'm going to have to be shooting up with a needle. People want to think I'm a junkie. You know, I went through this whole thing in my head until I went to my doctor, mm-hmm. and he said, no, you can live with this.
Mm-hmm.
He said, change your eating habits. And he said, what? He said, yeah, just change your eating habits. He said, exercise. That's when I exercised.
Mm-hmm.
He said, and we're going to put you on insulin. They put me on insulin. I said, is that all it is?
Mm-hmm.
Well, change my eating habits, exercise, and insulin? I mean, do my medication? He
mm-hmm.
said, yeah. So I went to a company called Sanofi.
Mm-hmm.
I said, listen, I'm going to get out there and talk to the community and let them know I can get diabetes. And it's such a high rate. At that time, there were 23 million people living with diabetes in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's 26 million. So I want to get on the campaign, and I want to let people know we can beat this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's why I started a website, Stand for Diabetes Support,
mm-hmm.
you know, to let people know we can beat this. You know, it's a simple thing. Change the dialogue around. Stop telling yourself that you have a challenge. No, you have an opportunity,
mm-hmm.
an opportunity towards better health. You are not suffering. You're living with diabetes. And once you change your dialogue about it, you'll start doing the things that are right for your body temple, which you've been blessed with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll stop eating, you know, you'll start eating the proper things for your body. You'll drink more water. You'll exercise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you'll do your medication. If you're on medication, if you're on insulin, do your insulin.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And you can live a good life with it. And if America would take the regimen of people living with diabetes to exercise more, eat the proper foods, we'd have a healthier country.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We have, like, I mean, we're from 23 to 26 million people in this country now living with diabetes.
Yeah.
And if we look at our young people, the obesity
mm-hmm.
is off the charts.
Yeah.
So I have to get out there. I have to get out there for my young people and for the health of the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been given this for a reason. This diabetes. I've been giving it for a reason, not to sit back and feel sorry for myself, but to get into the battle.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. and run front, head on, and say, we can defeat this
yes.
as a people when we come consciously together and stop being the people. I feel like people live with diabetes like it's like us, a Dr. Seuss is the Who.
Mm.
You know, we're the Who. The people living with diabetes are like the Who. Nobody knows we're here. We're screaming the American Diabetes of out there. Everyone's doing it. Conferences and everything. There's TOYC, which is also a company that I went to, and said, you've got to help me get the message out there. And I teamed up with them, and, you know, and they're out there. But how many people know about it? Then we say, we wonder why our country is feeling ill.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the information. We got to turn the dialogue around. As soon as a person gets, and yes, amputees happen. I'm not negating that the terrible, horrible things happen. Yes, amputee happens. Yes, death will happen. Yes, all these horrible things happen. But here's the good news.
Mm-hmm.
If we turn our consciousness around, we could do something about it in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
You know? And we'll save our children. We'll save our tomorrow, our generation. Will diabetes will go away in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely can.
It can.
It really can. I mean, there are certain types of diabetes that really can go away. And like
yeah.
you said, it's you know, what you eat and also your attitude, and the exercise is so important because
important.
It has to do with
important.
Circulation. And a
exactly.
lot of times the amputation happens because we're not moving enough.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, and those people living with type 1, you know, I love the story where this kid talks about the fact that, you know, he wouldn't go out because of the fact that he had to take his insulin, and he had type 1. And
mm-hmm.
he saw his team type 1, and they were cycling guys who cycle around team type 1. They're amazing. And he saw them on TV, and he told his mother, he said, Mom, I'm going to go to the park. And she said, you sure? He said, yeah. He went to the park, and he's sitting there, and he had to take his insulin shot. Check his blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid from across the park saw him
mm-hmm.
and came running over, and he looked at him and he said, you have diabetes? He said, yeah. He said, I have diabetes too. Because of the fact that he came out
mm-hmm.
and was not ashamed that he had to check his blood sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Another kid who had to check his blood sugar became, you know, okay with it.
Right.
And I want to get into the school system. I want to get into the young people.
Mm-hmm.
Those kids who are living in school with diabetes, they should be supported and become examples of good health.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have to exercise, they have to eat the proper foods,
right.
and they've got to do their insulin if they're on insulin.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It
yeah.
sounds simple to me. You want a healthier country, it sounds
mm-hmm.
simple to me.
Right, yeah, and it sort of goes right into a lot of our schools having, you know, gardens for the children, so they're growing
mm-hmm.
good, they're growing
exactly.
fresh food
exactly.
and eating more vegetables.
Mm-hmm. We need to embrace that.
Yeah.
We need to embrace that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because a lot of, you know, the diabetes comes from not having fresh food, you know, eating
exactly.
a lot of processed food. And
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. Oz has a group called Health Corps.
Mm.
You know, which I'm partnering with,
uh-huh.
you know, because they are in the school system.
Mm.
And when you're getting kids to think about health better, you know, better health.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I was just thinking as you were talking that, you know, you use, you know, these potentially, you know, heartbreaking or negative news, you know, as an opportunity.
Yes, exactly. Because what happens is when you throw out the negative and you try to frighten people, you know, you try to frighten them. Oh, you're going to have diabetes, and you're going to take your leg off, and all these horror stories. Instead of telling them, you can live with this.
Mm-hmm.
You can live with this. All you got to do is exercise more. All you got to do is your medication if you're on medication,
mm-hmm.
and watch what you eat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to eat all that sugar.
Right.
You know, you don't have to eat the whole cake and a slice of it, a thin slice. You don't have to eat the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Be moderate.
You know?
Yeah.
Moderation. and with the obesity today with young people,
mm-hmm.
we've got a job on our hands.
Mm-hmm.
A big job to make
yeah.
our country healthier
mm-hmm.
and make the world a healthier place.
Right.
Not
right.
just America, it's the world.
Mm-hmm.
26 million in America, 7 million who are living with it and don't even know they have it. And every 21 seconds, somebody else is diagnosed with diabetes.
It's a lot
of
people.
We've got a job ahead of us.
Yeah, certainly.
But we can do this. We can do this.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then, you know, they...
Tell them to go to my website, stanfordiabetes.org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Stan, S-T-A-N-D for diabetes,
yes.
definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also there have been some alternative treatments, like, you know, the raw food diet
exactly.
has really helped, you know,
exactly.
some people like not even need insulin
exactly.
or need less medicine. Oh, for real?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm a vegetarian. I raised my hand.
Oh, wow.
I'm a member.
That is so awesome.
Mm-hmm. But
wow.
That's my choice.
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah.
my choice. It might not be the choice for that person who's living with diabetes next door.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They may need something else for their diet. I'm not saying that my choice is my decision to be, you know, eat, you know, vegetarian or raw is right. It's right for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah. We were speaking to Ben Vereen. This is an archival interview. He was in town in June of this year. And we are so happy to be welcoming into the studio Greg Cappy, whose film, Shooting for Home, which is the story of Kevin Bradshaw, phenomenal basketball champion, is a part of the San Francisco Documentary Film Festival, and you have an opportunity to see it on Sunday and Monday. Good morning. How are you doing, Greg?
I'm doing great, Wanda. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm fine. Just reading over some of the notes you sent me, and, yeah, really looking forward to our conversation. And congratulations on your little baby.
Oh, thank you, baby Leo. He's really cute. His first birthday is coming up here in about a week, so we're excited about that, too, of course.
Oh, wow, that's so great. You know, getting you were given the award for best sports documentary in Los Angeles, right, recently, this past week or something?
Yes, last weekend we screened the movie at a film festival called the All Sports Los Angeles Film Festival, and we won the Audience Choice Award for Best Documentary, so we're super excited. A lot of people were there kind of laughing and crying and applauding, and it was a packed house. They even had to bring a couple of folding chairs into the theater to accommodate all the people that were showing up. So, yeah, we couldn't be more excited about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I was just thinking about, you know, sort of the interview with Ben Vereen, and he was talking about children, and your wife works as an elementary school teacher, and you also, you volunteer at a school in East L.A. Do you still do that? Do you have time to do that still?
Well, yes and no. I don't have time to really do anything right now, but I do volunteer. I do some teaching at night at a community college in the Valley, teaching English as a second language, and my wife teaches second grade. And like what Mr. Vereen was saying, it's like a lot of that education, you really can't succeed in the classroom if you don't have your proper nutrition. And I know that a lot of schools are really trying to focus on that so the kids can come in, you know, with the right amount of energy and feeling good so they can learn.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, yeah. And you are in California all the way from Gainesville, Florida. I mean, sort of like as far east as you can go. You're in the as far west as you can come.
I know. You know what's crazy is that I'm here from Gainesville, Florida, as far away as you could be. And Kevin Bradshaw, the subject of the documentary, he's also from Gainesville. That's how we know each other. But he lives in San Diego. So it's like very strange, one of the many strange coincidences that we both ended up in Southern California for 30 years.
Mm-hmm, right, right, yeah, yeah. And Kevin Bradshaw, I'm going to read the little blurb on your film, Shooting for Home. It says that he seemed destined for basketball greatness, a top prospect for college recruiters. He ultimately scored a record 72 points in one game, yet mysteriously the NBA passed him over, and the despondent Bradshaw left for a career in Israel. His playing remained strong, but personally he was falling apart until he fell in love with an Israeli woman who showed him the value of life and helped him reunite with his family for the first time in 20 years.
Yep.
And that is sort of an overview of the film, but you really have to see the film because you can't put it in a neat paragraph like that.
No, what's remarkable about that is like, it appears to be a sports story. It is a sports story. Kevin broke the record for the most points scored in a game. He broke Pistol Pete Maravich's record. And about 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, sorry, 21 years ago. But really, it's really a story more about family and love. And Kevin, coming from Gainesville, Florida, a very racially divided town where he grew up, fearing white people, and white people fear black people. It's just the way it was back then in that town in the South. So that's how Kevin grew up. And then that's the beginning of his journey. And at the end, he ends up living in a kibbutz in Israel where it's a community, all white people, Israeli, where he ended up immersed in this whole new culture, and he ended up falling in love with an Israeli woman and actually becoming an Israeli citizen and having a child. And I don't want to give too much more away, but that's kind of the gist of it.
Mm-hmm, right, right. And it's just amazing because you're also a basketball star, and you played and you played with, you know, with the protagonist, Kevin, you know, on the courts. And I guess sports must be a place where even if there's segregation, it sort of stops at that point. Is that what happens? Because, you know, living on different sides of the track, you say that you lived on the white side of the tracks and Kevin lived, as he mentions, on the black side. And you didn't socialize necessarily, but you played together, you know, as a team. So that's kind of an interesting dichotomy, huh?
You know, it is. And you know what? Anyone who plays sports could tell you, once you're on the court or on the field, there are no colors. Mm-hmm. You're just out there playing. You're trying to win. You're trying to be a good teammate. And nobody on that team thought it was half white and half black, and nobody even knew who was who. We're out there just playing ball. And Kevin talks about that in the movie, too, when he was in the Navy playing basketball with those guys. It's like, nobody cared what color you were. Nobody cared where you were from or what your past was. Everyone was the same in the Navy. And they all became brothers that way because nobody was really thinking about any of that stupid stuff about where you're from or if you have any money or your culture background. Is like, we're all the same. And that's what's wonderful about sports.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, yeah. So you know, there you are, you know, in Southern California, you know, after you graduated from high school, you know, you went on to University of Florida, got your BA in English and an MA in sociology, and you're steadily moving your way up in the ranks of basketball, officiating, becoming a Division I NCAA official at the age of 27. That's very young. You must be very good.
Well, yeah. You know what's funny? Like, I was a basketball official. I wasn't good enough to really play after high school, so I just decided to become a referee. And the next thing you know, I was moving my way up the food chain of refereeing. I got to this point at 27. I was already working major college basketball games. And I said, well, if I could do this, I could do anything. Maybe I'll just move to L.A. and make movies, because that's what I've always really wanted to do. And it took me 17 years to make this movie after I made that decision.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. But you were writing short stories, and you got a few published in literary anthologies. You know,
I did, and that's even harder. Yeah, that's even harder, Wanda. It's hard to write a short story, to tell a whole story in two or three pages and have one of these literary journals publish it. Those are big accomplishments, I think, more or less.
Right, right, yeah. But you must have had a really unique kind of a rearing, because you worked in a correctional rehabilitation center for people with psychological problems, and then you worked as a teacher in middle school with at-risk, quotation around that, children, when you were still in Gainesville before you moved this way. And when you have time, when you're not making this great movie, and now, you know, taking it around, letting all of us see it, you know, you volunteer. So, sort of talk about how Kevin got in touch with you and you started this journey, because usually the director has the idea for the film and then they go out and make it. This time the subject got in touch with you and started talking to you, and because people had lost contact with Kevin, because he actually left the country and no one knew what happened to him for like 20 years. He went, when he graduated from high school, how do you pronounce the name of that high school?
Buchholz High School in Gainesville,
yeah.
Florida.
Yeah, everybody was courting him, and he could have went to some of the best universities, big, and he decided to go to a black university, Bethune-Cookman, and it was like... he talks about that, in the film, and then he joins the Navy, and that's an interesting experience. And when he gets out, he goes to university, and it's just, you know, just a great journey. But let's go back to my initial question. Talk about talking to Kevin after not speaking to him for 30 years, I think you said.
Yeah, it was crazy, because it's funny. I've been writing short stories and writing screenplays and having some success with some of my things, but nothing, I hadn't really created anything that I felt passionate about. And I've been here in Los Angeles for 16, 17 years, just not quite passionate about anything I'm really working on. And then one day, and you're right, it never happens like this. Kevin called me up out of the blue. I don't even know how I got my phone number. I don't know why he called me. We both laugh about that to this day. But he said, hey, this is Kevin Bradshaw, that guy that never used to pass the ball back in high school. And I thought I was talking to a ghost. I really did. Because he was always in so much trouble when we were kids and with drugs and getting in fights. And he's just one of those kids. He just figured, well, you forget all about him. And so I really thought he was going down that path. And he called me up and he just told me his story a little bit. And I knew he lived in San Diego, so we met for lunch. And wow, we were there all day, and he was just telling me his story, and I was like, wow, this is the story that I was actually meant to tell. And he said, well, I think he took a chance on me, and he said, well, I think you're the one that I want to tell it. Mm-hmm. And so that was about 2 years ago, and we've been off to the races ever since.
Wow. So was he at that screening in Southern California that you mentioned about the sports films? Did he make
yes.
it to that?
Yes, he was there last weekend and with
nice.
His sister, Tawanda, and it was just a really great experience for him. He's seen the movie a couple times, and, you know, someone's making a movie about you, so he had to have a lot of faith in me to do that. But every time he sees it, he cries, and a good cry, so he feels good about it, and that makes me feel good.
Yeah. So I presume, you know, because the film is as much a documentary telling, you know, Kevin's story as telling the story of a region, telling the story of a period. It's quite a journey.
It is. I mean,
yeah.
It's not just a story about an individual, Kevin, and his journey. It is. It's a sports story, and it's a journey about him falling in love and all those things. But you're right. It is a story about the South and Kevin going to this small black school in Florida thinking that if I go here, I'm going to get all kinds of special favors because I'm black and that's the way they're going to treat me. But he found out real fast that that's not the case, and they kicked him right out of that school. And so we examined that a little bit about some of, you know, Bethune-Cookman in Florida, and some of the characters in the story talk about black schools in the South. And, you know, a lot of those schools are located, as the characters say in the story, they're right in the middle of the ghetto. So it's like you're trying to go there to get an education and work hard. All around the school, liquor stores, gun shops, got people selling drugs on the corner. And, you know, I can't speak these other schools, but I know Bethune-Cookman, when we were there, it's a wonderful school. It's a fantastic school. But it's true. A stone's throw away from there, you have all kinds of trouble. We drove around, and Kevin showed me some of these places, and you're presented with additional challenges at some of those schools, at least at Bethune-Cookman. Kevin talks about that a lot in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then also within the film, some of the themes that come up are, you know, are trauma. I mean, there's abuse in his home, and he is, you know, the victim of that abuse, you know, physical abuse from his father. And so what does a child do with that? And for him, you know, he channels that into his game. You know, that's where he's happy. But then he's got to go home, where things are not necessarily any better. And your film touches on that too. And you've got this, you know, this young child who is, you know, an innocent victim trying to manage it. So, you know, so he's self-medicating, you know, with these drugs and this drinking, and he's getting all this positive strokes outside of his home, you know, for his game, which is good, you know, that he's getting, you know, all this positive attention. But then you've got this trauma that's just sort of lingering and not being dealt with, and you show without words through just sort of this profile of Kevin Bradshaw that one has to deal with. It. You can't just keep pushing this aside. And I'm sure, I don't know if, you know, within your study as in sociology or not, but I'm sure that you have some academic kind of sort of theories around this.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of that just came from a life experience that I have and what I think a lot of people have.
Mm-hmm.
We don't, like you said, Kevin won't play basketball during the day as almost like a medication, a way to make himself feel good because he was afraid of what was going to happen when he came home. And a lot of people feel that way. They might not be getting specifically hit or abused, but a lot of people, like, they don't want to come in the front door. They want to come in the back door like Kevin, like, or you want to sneak through a window. And so we try to like play up this or tell the story of fear and tension in the home. So some people come from home been abused physically or just even neglected, or there's just a sense of terror in the house, or nervousness. And so I felt that. I think a lot of people, most people have felt that. And so Kevin had to learn, as you see in the movie, you don't always get your medication. If you stop taking drugs and you stop playing basketball, eventually you have to feel those feelings that you've been trying to medicate and you've been trying to hide. And so that's what finally happened to him when he was in Israel. When he got hurt and couldn't play basketball anymore, he had to come to grips with, you know, he had to find some inner peace, and that's what he talks about after all these years. And then to go back to Gainesville, back to his house where these things happened, after not seeing any of his family members for 20 years, that's I won't spoil it and say how it ended, but mm-hmm. how it ends, but you've seen it, so it's pretty interesting ending.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the suspense is just so fantastic. I mean, we are hanging off our seats. We are jumping up and down. I mean, you can do that when you're not in the theater because you have to jump up and down in the aisle. It's like, oh, my God. Oh, no. Oh, ah.
There's some twists and turns, you know.
Yeah,
you know, it's not
mm-hmm.
crazy. So.
Yeah. Talk about these great interviews. I mean, oh, my goodness, you talk to all these basketball stars. You talk to his family. You travel. Talk about all the different places where you and your camera went.
Sure. Well, the biggest one, the most important element of the whole movie and the thing that I and the rest of the crew that we're most touched by is Kevin's family in Florida. They let us into their home. And I don't know how many people would let a crew into their house to ask them very personal questions or to film them in their house like the way they let us do it. But that was the biggest thing that we were most touched by. His mother, I mean, they let us film this reunion, and those are very, very private moments. So many thanks to Kevin's wonderful family for letting us into their home. So that was what that is. But we did. We flew to Florida and interviewed his old high school teammates. And we all went down to San Diego and tried to catch up with a bunch of the people that he played with in the Navy. And then the big one, one of the bigger ones, is we went to San Antonio, Texas, and we sat down and got to talk with David Robinson, NBA Hall of Famer, who some people know, but most people don't know, that Kevin played with him on the Navy ships in these Navy leagues back in the 1980s. So that was a great experience too.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then you know, those moments when he was in the Navy and all that archival footage, that's really great, I'm sure, for you as a director, that there was all this footage of Kevin as a youngster playing and all these different, like when he was in Israel playing for that team and, you know, all of that, I'm sure was really great because you didn't have to recreate it. But talk about, the interviews with I'm not certain was he an officer, but the person on the ship that really gave Kevin a reality mm-hmm. check and helped him, like, stop being so angry and
sure.
settle down.
Yeah, that was Earl McKinney was an officer on the ship, and he kind of ran unofficially what was called the ship's jail. So if Kevin was acting like a knucklehead, they threw Kevin right into the ship's jail on the bottom of the ship. Mm-hmm. And that's another example. This is a black officer, and Kevin thought, well, you know, he's black and I'm black, so he's going to give me a break, and he's going to let things slide. But that didn't happen. So that's the first person in Kevin's life that he talks about that actually showed him some real tough love.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the one big moment, one big attribute of that of Earl McKinney. But the second biggest one, Earl McKinney was married to a white woman, and Kevin's like, what? He invited Kevin over to his house for dinner, and like Kevin says in the movie, I can't believe you're married to a white woman. So that was the first time Kevin said, wait a second, wait, you mean black people and white people can like live together, they can be together, I don't have to be afraid of white people, and like there's genuine love, brotherly love in this world. So that was a big turning point, not just the tough love aspect that Earl McKinney brought to Kevin, but it opened Kevin's eyes to the world a bit, and he started from that minute on in the Navy, started to see things in a different light.
Mm-hmm. Right. And also, I think within the Navy, Kevin started looking at himself differently. I think his self-esteem grew as well, because not only was he good in basketball, but he also was a great student. And you show that when you follow him in his academic career. Why don't you talk about that a little bit, and about I had never heard of universities just closing on people. That was an interesting story.
Well, that's crazy. I mean, when he got out of the Navy, he had 2 years of eligibility left and to play college basketball, and he went to a school called U.S. International University in San Diego. And it was a major college, but a smaller major college. And as soon as Kevin went there and started lighting it up and breaking all these records, they got the news that the school was going bankrupt. So here they are taking vans to games, or they lost all their coaches, or the other team's trainers were taping their ankles, this kind of thing. So all the teachers were kind of getting laid off, and a lot of the students left the school. And really, it was just Kevin and the basketball team and one coach driving around playing their games. It was crazy.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. But at the university, the International University in San Diego, he meets this wonderful teacher who sort of believes in his capacity to learn, even if he is behind, and she catches him up, and they make an agreement. I just think those little stories within the story, they're just, you know, they're really, you know, really rich. Rich moments that's like, oh, okay, I'm getting the lesson here.
You know, it's funny, Dr. Bandy, that woman, it's funny because I'm no expert in it more than anyone else, but we all have our journeys. And on these journeys, we can't do these things alone. We need people in our lives and to help us. And we might not know that, and we might not know what's happening to us, but like Kevin met this woman who tutored him and kind of took him under her wing a little bit and helped him out. And that was another little turning point. And it's funny you bring that up, because people that come up to me after seeing the movie, they say, you know what, I really love the character. I feel like I know the people that you interviewed, because they're so rich. And you're right, Wanda, each little story has become its own, each character has become its own little story, on, you know, a part of Kevin's journey.
Right, yeah. And so did you go to Israel?
No, we didn't go to Israel. We got all the, like you said, all this footage of him playing, which was really hard to find. But we did get some good footage, and we had someone that we knew that had been in Israel and had some really great photography of some of the places, just coincidentally, where Kevin had been. So we were able to put that in the movie. We ran out of money, so we weren't able to go.
So where did your money, where did your funding come from for the film?
Well, basically, since I've been here in L.A., you know, I've been working as a location scout and a location manager on movies for a handful of, had been doing that for a handful of years. And then I started a company just renting equipment to movie studios, which, you know, wasn't very exciting. It still isn't really exciting, a very exciting venture. But I was able to save a little bit of money, and every year I'd save a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And so long story short, I saved all the money to make the movie. And so I funded the movie with all out of my own pocket, and then by pulling a lot of favors from people I know here in town, here in L.A., that could do things like help me with the music and the photography, and I was able to pay them a little bit. But I ended up pulling, like most independent filmmakers, a lot of favors and using my own money.
Wow, that's really, really phenomenal. So are you going to be in San Francisco for your screenings?
I sure am. Yeah, actually, I'm flying up to San Francisco, actually, just in a couple hours, so I'll be in San Francisco this afternoon, and the movie is actually playing, I think you might have said Sunday, Monday, I'm not sure, but it's playing tomorrow. It's playing
Saturday.
Saturday.
Yeah, because the date says, it's the 17th, but the day says Sunday. Okay, because I thought they meant the 18th. Oh, so
there was a mistake
Saturday.
In there. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So
tomorrow, 12:30.
So Saturday is a Saturday at 12:30 or 2:30?
Saturday at 12:30 and Sunday night at 9:30.
Oh my goodness, I got the wrong.
That's
time.
Not your fault. It was wrong on the website for a while.
but both are at the Roxy.
At the Roxy Theater, Saturday 12:30 and Sunday at 9:30. Yep.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I got to change that. Okay. Oh, awesome. Is Kevin going to come up too?
I am twisting his arm. He is probably now up to 60% sure that he is coming for the screening tomorrow, because a lot of people are going to be there that want to see him. And I know he wants to come, so I can't say for sure because I don't want to ruin it if he doesn't show up, but
yeah.
I'm pretty sure he's going to be there. So,
you're going to play a little one-on-one for us.
He would kill me. He could still shoot. Trust me. We're on the same team, but he was the only one that could really play. So he would kill me.
Oh, that's so funny. Let me play this clip that you sent me, and then we'll talk a little bit more.
Okay.
In the world of sports, it's not uncommon to star on a team with few stars. In college basketball, it's Kevin Bradshaw of U.S. International.
He was almost like watching an acrobat.
The best scorer that I've ever seen.
Kevin, one of the best basketball players in the country.
Pete Maravich's 69-point mark became Kevin Bradshaw's 72-pointer.
72 points on a record that some people never thought would be broken.
People used to think it was so great. Kevin Bradshaw is your brother. Oh, he did this, and I knew my brother. I knew what he was going through privately, and it was not what people try to make it out to be.
I had a gun. My plan was to go in outside and blow my brains out. And she told me if I loved her, I wouldn't do it. That's why I say she saved my life.
Love saved his life, right?
That's what he says. Love saved his life. Saved my life, too. I think love has saved a lot of people's lives. If you just let it in and love yourself and let other people love you, then it might happen. And that's definitely what happened to Kevin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell me about the music. Who was playing that guitar?
Thank you. That's a great question. A gentleman named Mark Scarce. He lives in Los Angeles, and I was pulling my hair out trying to find the perfect person to, the person who could really feel what we were trying to do in the story and capture it with his music. And Mark is a Southern guy, too, and so we were thinking, what can we do that might have a Southern flair a little bit, but also we want it to be sort of theatrical and kind of capture the emotions. And like everyone else on the crew, we didn't have a big crew, but everybody felt passionate about the story, and I could just hear from sitting down with Mark and hear from his music that this is the guy I want to do the music. And he not only wrote, but he performed all of the music in the movie except for one song at the end. So yeah, he was great. I love it.
Nice. And who else is on your crew?
We had a gentleman named Antonio Dominic, who's our sound mixer here in Los Angeles, and he came with us to Florida. And so he was the guy that basically in charge of making it sound so good. And Daniel Herman is our director of photography. He was just, at least in my opinion, unbelievable. He really just captured some great images and made everybody look good. And then the biggest hero in the movie is a woman from Finland, the editor of the movie, and her name is Marit Nisela. And she is the one who I worked together with her for months and months and months to really put the story together. I knew what the story was, but she's the one who has to sit there in front of the computer and pull all the sound bites from the different people and help build the story through images. And she was really fantastic. And, you know, she's from Finland, barely even knew what basketball was. And but she knew a lot about story. She didn't know basketball, but she knew about human emotions. And again, she felt passionate about the project. So a small crew, but a great crew. And then also Chris Schauerman and Christian Krieger, my two sort of right-hand men, they're my associate producers that helped me out a lot, just sort of helping me standing by my side for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Let the audience know that we're speaking to director great, Kathy, about his film Shooting for Home, which is part of the San Francisco Documentary Film Festival, and it screens on Saturday, November 17th, to 12:30 p.m., and again on Sunday, November 18th at 9:30 p.m., both at the Roxy Theater in San Francisco on 16th Street. Do you happen to know the address on 16th? I don't know. I just know that you just get off on 16th Street Bar and just walk up the street. You don't even have to cross.
I'm not really sure. I just know I'm excited to fly up there today and check out the Roxy Theater. There's a lot of other good movies playing, too, but I encourage everyone to come and check out the story. It's you might not be the same after seeing it. It's a pretty fun ride.
Mm-hmm, certainly. And possibilities of a theatrical release in Southern California and Northern California and nationwide?
Well, that's our goal. I mean, our goal is pretty simple. We want the most amount of people to be able to see the movie and be touched by Kevin's story and be entertained by it. So we're not really sure what the exact game plan is, whether that would be a theatrical release or something that might be better suited for a television network. We're not really sure, but it seems to feel more like a movie. People are coming up to me saying, this isn't a normal sports documentary that you just see like the biography of a basketball or a football player or something. It feels more like a movie. So it might belong in a theater. We're still trying to figure that out, but the future, I think, looks bright. People so far like it, so we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's really wonderful. So in our concluding moments, so what's going on with Kevin now, and what's going on? Are you, like, now that you have this successful film, are you, like, toying with some ideas?
Well, Kevin is a teacher and a counselor at a school in San Diego, California.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a tough guy, and his students love him. He's got tough students that need a tough person there teaching them, and he's just the guy to do it. So that's where his story is right now. He's down in San Diego working hard, helping other people, helping teenagers, you know, to keep from making some of the mistakes he made, sooner rather than later. So he's doing a great job down there doing that. As far as I'm concerned, or as far as, you know, what I'm up to, right now it's 24/7 focused on getting the movie out there and still working on this one and taking care of my beautiful baby Leo and my wife Alice and juggling everything I juggle before I move on to the next project. But I definitely have a couple good ideas brewing for when the dust settles a little bit on this.
Right, yeah. I'm sure having such a successful first film project that's award-winning already, and you haven't even, you know, you probably have more awards coming that you can't even imagine. I bet that really makes you feel good and feel really confident that, yes, I can make films.
You know what? It makes me feel relieved because Kevin Bradshaw gave me the keys to his life and said, here, turn this into a story. I trust you. And the fact that another human being and another family trusted me to bring his story to life, and when he sees the movie, he hugs me and doesn't, like, want to punch me. That's what means the most to me, is that someone trusted me to do something, and I and the rest of the crew, we've done Kevin proud, at least, and so far people seem to really like the movie.
That's great. And what about his wife and son? What do they think?
Well, his wife really loves it, and she was a little tentative because, again, she's interviewed in the movie and ends up being a major part of the movie because she's the one that Kevin fell in love with. And so here's Kevin working on this movie for a year and having these people come into the house and interview everybody. And she was very tentative at first, like probably everybody would be, but she really loved the movie. So that was maybe even a bigger relief that she loved it. And, you know, his son likes it too. His son Deshaun is about, I think he's 10 years old now, and he's super cute. Yeah, he's super cute. You probably see him in the movie too. If you you know, anyone who watches the movie has a little cameo too. So.
Oh yeah, he's great. Particularly when he sees all of his father's trophies, and I just think that's so lovely the way Kevin's mother has all of these trophies, and they're like, they don't fill one cabinet. They're like all over the place. It's just so many. He's just so good.
Yeah, well, that's a mom right there, loving her son, and. My mom loves me like that, too. I just don't have any trophies like Kevin does. But still, you know, that was an interesting experience being in their house with his mother. She's a wonderful woman.
Yeah, and then you could visit your family, too, because you live from there as well.
That's it. That's it. Mm-hmm. So I always look forward to opportunities to go back to Florida. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, your mom might not have trophies, but your mom has a film now.
Yeah, that's right. She's proud of me. She came to the screening last week, too. Of course, she was crying, probably not because of the movie, just, oh, look at my baby boy doing all this. So it's exciting. It's a family affair for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, congratulations, Greg, and safe travels. And I just love that you were able to fit this into your schedule. You must be really well organized to be able to, like, I have a flight today, like, in a little bit. And to be able to and just to be so calm, like, wow, you are so good. I don't know if I could have an interview right before I get on a plane. I'm always missing my flights.
Learned how to fake it, Wanda. I just learned how to fake it. That's all. I seem calm, but I'm probably nervous right now. Don't worry.
All right. Well, you take good care and safe travels to San Francisco.
Thanks, Wanda. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. You take good care. And congratulations, then, okay. And good luck on your next projects.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Take care now.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, wow. That was a great interview with director Greg Cappy, and you definitely want to try to catch him tomorrow, Saturday or Sunday when he's in San Francisco, and who knows, you might have a surprise at the screening. We shall see tomorrow, 12:30 at the Roxy, November 17th, and then 9:30 p.m. On Sunday, the 18th, so that's going to really be great. So we are going to play another song. Let's see. I wish I, maybe I'll play a Ben Vereen song since we were chatting with him. Let's play Defying Gravity because that's what basketball players do. They defy gravity. They fly in the air.
Wicked. I went into the show with Shoshana Bean, and each night I'd hear Shoshana sing this song. I'd like to do it for you now. Something has changed within me. Something is not the same. I'm through with playing by the rules of someone else's game. Too late for second guessing. Too late to go back to sleep. It's time I trust my instincts, close my eyes, and leave. It's time to try defying gravity. I think I'll try defying gravity, and you can't hold me down. Through accepting limits because someone said they're so. Some things I can never change, but till I try, I'll never know. So tired of being afraid of losing love I thought I had lost. Well, if that's love, it comes at much too high a cost. I'd rather buy defying gravity. Defying gravity, and you can't hold me down. Unlimited, my future is unlimited. And I just had a vision, almost like a prophecy. Oh, I know this may sound crazy, and it's true. The vision is hazy, but I swear, someday I'll be up in the sky, defying gravity. Yes, I can fly, I'll defy gravity, and you can't hold me down. You can't hold me down, no! Everyone deserves a chance to fly. And if I'm flying solo, message